Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
And I can hear you. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great.
I'm in Williamsburg, where we've been having some spotty connectivity for streams and stuff, but this visit it's been good. So I just did a video thing with Dan Pancaldi and Aardwolf last night and had no problems. So hopefully those no problems today. But if I blank out or my voice goes out, it usually lasts for 30 seconds or so, and then I come back. But it hasn't happened recently.
Most of us that talk to you are used to those 30-second
Yeah,
blackouts.
that's right.
Didn't
Yeah,
realize it was technology.
I'm like a wargaming Mitch McConnell.
This is the second of a three-part series of discussions about the August 2023 event by SD HISCON at the U.S. Navy War College Museum. This podcast is composed of discussions with Rob Doan, the museum curator, Mark Miklos, the designer of GMT Games' Battles of the American Revolution, the great Vonko Runka, and Mike Zilblitz-Smart. We start the discussion with museum curator Rob Doan.
Our museum is not just anywhere in some random location. It is where it is for a reason. It's in the building where the Naval War College got its start when it was founded in 1884. So we're in that original building. Now we're a museum about the college and about the Navy in Narragansett Bay, but we're in that historic building for that reason. So we can kind of tell the history of the locale where we are and why the Navy chose that place to found this school where officers come to do this, you know, harebrained year-long course of study with their head in the clouds, thinking about big strategic thoughts and all that good stuff. Our museum is fortunate in that we get a lot of support from the Navy. We're part of a system of museums that the Navy runs, actually. We're run by something called Naval History and Heritage Command, which is a command that's headquartered in D.C. On the Washington Navy Yard. But they're the entity within the Navy that kind of organizes all of the Navy's historical efforts. So that includes museums. It also includes official commemorations of important, you know, anniversaries, the Battle of Midway anniversary every year. They organize the efforts to mark those occasions. And they also run the Navy's activities doing underwater archaeology. So whenever there's a shipwreck that's discovered or a World War II ship that's been found, finally, a lot of times NHHC is going to be on the lead of that, taking charge of that and organizing the effort to retrieve some artifacts if they can. And then hopefully those artifacts come to our museum. So we're all kind of connected in that way. But we do, since we have that level of support for the Navy, they, you know, provide us a budget, they pay our salaries, they provide just about everything we need to keep up and running. So I know what you mean by the small museums. That fortunately, we are not a small, struggling nonprofit. We are a nonprofit since we're part of the government, but we are not just reliant on a small group of diehard museum people and volunteers. We do have that support to make it look, presentable, hopefully, at least. I mean, we're not on the level of the Smithsonian, obviously. We don't have any near the facilities and resources that they do, but we're enough to make it look like, hopefully, a professionally run museum, yeah.
You know, to bring it around to board gaming, I know you're a longtime board gamer, and you work closely with Mark on Battles of the American Revolution and development of a lot of his work. But you'll appreciate our concern bringing a bunch of war gamers into your museums.
I'm happy to say we didn't have to kick anybody out of the convention, so that's a good thing. No, I mean, we're used to dealing with that. We have groups that come in for tours in the museum. Sometimes veterans groups come in, and they're great to have. Obviously, we want them. But yeah, there are from time to time we might have functions or events in the museum where there's food and drink present, and you know, we're kind of used to managing that to make sure that the collection is obviously being protected. But we also want to show it off and help people learn from it. as well. So no, I mean, we did very well in that regard. You know, Ryan and I didn't have to stay till midnight cleaning up after you guys had all left. So appreciate that. We weren't mopping up wine stains and, you know, ground in hamburger on the carpet or anything like that. We made out okay. And no artifacts were harmed in the making of this convention. We can say that for sure. Everything is under glass and cases for that reason. So, I mean, we weren't too much worried about that. But yeah, the random, you know, people setting their drink on top of a display case, we tried to make sure people knew just to be careful of what they were doing. And everybody was. I was very happy to see. I think the nice thing about having war gamers in the museum is that there are people by and large who have a great appreciation for those historical objects. And they kind of, you know, I think we can trust them a little more than the general population to to do the right thing around them and not, you know, behave in too reckless a manner or, you know, to the point where we'd be worried about it. So yeah, everybody was great. And I think everybody appreciated their surroundings. And so it was great. It was a win-win as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And you know, it wouldn't have happened without all of the work that you put in and the support of Ryan, the director, and your team. So, you know, another thanks, but you know, it was a tremendous amount of effort. Did it fit within the scope of what your charge is to run a bunch of war gamers through? Certainly at the Naval War College, there's a, you know, war game means something specific.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, no, it absolutely did. I mean, for our museum, yeah, I mean, our mission is to be obviously first and foremost an educational facility for the college and the students at the college and the other people on the base who are at the other schools on the base to be a resource for them, of course. But we also have part of our mission to reach the general public and just help them understand what the Navy does at the Naval War College. You know, the college, a lot of people, I think, have not heard of the War College. They're more familiar with things like the Naval Academy and West Point. You know, they kind of know those places, have at least a general understanding of what those schools do. But most people in the public, I think, don't really know what the Naval War College is about, if they've heard of it at all. So part of our mission is to help them understand that and why there's a need for it. And of course, wargaming is a huge component of that. So the more that we can help show people what wargaming is all about, that's certainly a, you know, of the exhibits that you see in our museum, we have a couple areas where we talk about wargaming specifically. And and I think the great thing that we can do that I think this event served perfectly was to help be in some ways kind of the point, the intersection between the hobby side of wargaming and the professional side. You know, we're pretty much perfectly poised to be that kind of bridge between the two. So if we can bring in people for a weekend war game convention where we're just playing, you know, commercially available games that we all know and love, and then on top of that, we can expose them a little bit to, you know, how it's both similar and different from professional war gaming. Certainly there's a lot of similarities and there's a lot of, you know, ideas that one takes from the other. And people who are into war games are always very curious and excited to see professional wargaming done. Unfortunately, it's something I always have to tell people we can't show them. It's not open to the public, obviously, for security reasons. I wish that we could. I wish we could take people over there and have them just watch these war games in progress. But since we can't do that, the next best thing is to bring them in to the museum and let's, you know, do what we did, play a bunch of games. And then while we're at it, take a tour of the college, meet some of the professionals who actually do wargaming for a living, hear their side of it, and just, you know, kind of learn from each other. So to me, that was what the weekend was very much all about. And it was just great to see that happen. You know?
There was no small amount of professional wargamers in the mix with us.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think, of course, Sebastian Bay was there with his game, which, you know, I see pictures of all the time with surrounded by people in uniform. Right. So,
yeah,
which is very cool. But, you know, the other cool game was there. I can't remember the name of it, but Paul Weber was there with his with the kind of the operational.
Yeah. The, The OWS, I think, Operational War Game. I got to look up the title of it too. But yes, yeah, he was there showing off that, which is not a published game, unfortunately, and a lot of people were asking about it. But yeah.
Yeah, and it was awesome, right? It was basically the next, well, you know, a hypothetical model of what conflict would be like in the Pacific in modern in modern times, with immense detail, and you know, the poor guy was just covered up with interest.
What was the one where we started out the weekend with three tables in there, and I think by the middle of the day Saturday we had set up three more. We had about six tables crammed in there because there was so much interest, and I was afraid that people were going to complain that they were being jam-packed into this small space, which we had never planned for originally, but because of the demand that was there, we set up more, and it seemed to work out okay. Everybody was still happy to be there. So apologies if there wasn't much room to pull your chair out there, but we had to improvise a little bit there.
Right.
But it was a good problem to have, right? It was much better to have that than empty galleries and nobody else.
Right. No, that's our predict the supply and demand predictability is a problem for us, but it was very popular, and he's actually coming to San Diego, and he's going to demo it there. But that's a game, you know, again, as you said, unpublished, not published, not available. And you could see it at the convention, and man, it was, you know, if I had a weekend to spend and do nothing else, I would have sat there beside him and let him share his knowledge and talk through the game. So that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And unique. Now you're a gamer from way back. Have you been playing since you were young? What's your war game story?
From way back in the 90s. Yeah. not as much not as far back as others, but yeah, no, I got my start in high school like a lot of people. I came to it because I came to it through an uncle of mine who played a little bit when he was in college in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And he got into Avalon Hill War Games then and had gotten out afterwards, but he still knew of them. And of all the games that brought me into the hobby, this all came about because of a family trip that I took to Yellowstone in junior high sometime. But while we were there, my uncle, who was on this trip, got the vaunted Avalon Hill game Yellowstone, which was on sale in the gift shop there, and gave it to us as a Christmas present, just as a reminder of that trip, I think. And we had a great time playing. It was actually, if anybody knows about it, it is absolutely a war game in disguise. I mean, you're moving little animal herds that move through hexes and have zones of control, and it's very, very thinly veiled, but after playing it for a while, I just, at some point, I remember one day I kind of was digging through the box a little more and found the Avalon Hill catalog in the bottom of the box and opened it up and suddenly saw, whoa, all these other games that have tanks and airplanes and not elk and mule deer, you know? It's like, oh, that got my attention real quick. And since I was getting interested in history anyway at that point, studying it in high school, then it was a pretty natural fit. So yeah, I mean, I came in and got my start with Avalon Hill games just as they were, you know, getting ready to fold, unfortunately. But I played, you know, with a couple friends through high school and then got out of it during college and afterwards, but eventually got back into it after maybe a 10-year break or so. And I've been going ever since.
Yeah, so true of many of us, right? Took that time around college and after to do other things, and then sort of came back to the hobby that was so interesting to us earlier in our lives. You work with Mick Miklos on his Battles of the American Revolution series, and you're also a highly rated player of Battles of the American Revolution series, and I can vouch for that, given that not only am I a low rated player, but you mop the floor with me in playing Battle of Rhode Island. How did you get involved in that series?
Yeah, boy, trying to think when I first became aware of the series. Well, it was through WBC. I used to be a regular at going to the World Board Gaming Championships every year. I've not been able to go for the past few years, having a having a young son, a 5-year-old now, and then makes it a little bit harder to just pull away for a week and go to conventions like that. So part of the allure of having a convention in my museum is that's the only way I'm going to get to a convention lately. So may as well just host one where I work. So then I have to go. It's part of my duties. So that's and a pretty elaborate way to get an excuse to game. I guess that's how it turned out. But yeah, I think 1 year, and I don't remember what year it was. It was, it's been, geez, at least 10 years, I think. It may have been about 10 years ago or so when one of the WBCs I was at, I think I was looking for something to play and saw that series. And Saratoga was of interest to me because when I was in grad school, I did a summer internship at Saratoga as an interpreter on their battlefield, a historical interpreter. So I was actually stationed out at one of the tour stops on the battlefield and talking to visitors about the battle through there. So when I saw there was a game about it, then yeah, I was definitely interested in that. And I ended up playing it at one of those WBCs and enjoyed it. Wasn't any good at it at the start, but had to learn a little bit about, you know, the tactics of the game and what works well in the game. But yeah, it appealed to me because of the subject matter and you know, as war game rule books go, it's not a terribly thick one. So it was not too high a barrier for me to get into. And then, yeah, I think after a while, I started getting a little bit more involved in the playtesting and helping Mark out with it. I started doing vassal modules for the series. And once I was able to do that for them, that made it possible to playtest a little more since we could do more of it online then and just get more people involved. So I just kind of got more into it that way. And as I met Mark and talked to him and talked to some of the other regulars, you know, who go to those conventions, I just felt like, yeah, it's a very good core group of people who are kind of the ones who do most of the playtesting. It's a good group of guys who are really friendly and really knowledgeable, and we get along well to each other. We always laugh and joke at every convention we're at. And you know, I know when we go to these like WBC, we're competitive about it and, you know, trying to win the games, but we still, you know, at the end of the day, we're having fun. We're laughing about telling stories about what happened in our games, just like everyone. And it's just a fun atmosphere. I think for me, when I first got into it, I was pretty competitive and, I really liked the tournament style appealed to me. I sort of liked the idea of sitting down with a person and going one-on-one them and just seeing who can play better and who can win. And I still do like that very much, but the getting to know the other players who did that, you know, we've all become a good group of friends too. And it's a nice, it kind of hits the sweet spot between the social and the competitive side of gaming for me. So it's that tournament has always appealed to me, and the guys who are involved in it appealed to me. So it's been fun.
Anything that promotes more play of mixed games, I think, is a good thing. You know, I'm not a competitive player, probably because I'm not very good, and so it's not the path that I'm on. But you know, one of the things about that Battle of the American Revolution series is that I've noticed, not only does, when Mick talks about the battles, it's as if he was there, right? I'm pretty sure he was and has, you know, time traveled back, but
he's at least channeling somebody who was, if not him himself. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question. And the great thing about that game and the people that play it is that you're right. The stories, right? About, and it's not, you know, it's not this, you don't hear a whole bunch of, you know, the odds and this and that. It's talking about the leaders and the units and the movement and the locations, right? And they're great. They're just excellent stories that evoke a lot more than just the engineering of a war game, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, whenever a group of us are together, like we were at SDSCon East, I think a standard part of any convention experience is like telling tales of conventions past, right? It's like the games from, and it's like, I don't know, for me, I think a lot of people are like this way. Somehow, like, you never remember the great story from the games you win. It's the games you lost that are the ones that stick in your brain. And you have these great stories of like, oh, I made this one wrong move and I did this, and then this crazy thing happened and I lost the game. And like, it, it sticks with you, but for all the good reasons, right? Like it's they provide fodder for, you know, telling tales over drinks later on, years later. And that still happens. I know whenever we get together, I always talk about Mark with Mark. We talk about things that happened in games from 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago sometimes, just because they were, you know, they stood out so much. And his games are, I think, are good at producing that kind of stuff because he does put so many great little pieces of chrome and special details in the game to reflect, you know, some of the things that happened historically in these battles, not tying you to the exact same sequence, but opening up the possibility for, you know, sometimes chaotic things to happen that you have to deal with as a player, and you have to accept that you don't have full control over what happens to your army in the game, as any you know, good, I think, student of that era realizes, is that, like with most war games, you know, we have so much more control over what happens than the historical participants actually did, especially an 18th century field commander. They had to deal with not knowing and not having the information that we have as war gamers when we're looking down at the map and seeing the exact position of every unit and every piece on the map. So having to, the things that mess that up a little bit and force you to react to unknowns, his games, the BOAR series, are good at producing moments like that. And hence the tales of woe that last decades later, sometimes after the fact, and that we can still laugh over. So, yeah.
You know, the part of the strength of, as you said, of Mark's games, details, and he, in the map, in the Battle of Rhode Island, has a tremendous amount of detail, including a couple of locations that we visited. And actually, you and I, you know, parked and got out of the car and walked and looked over somebody's fence at a couple of locations too, right? The
yeah,
certainly, you know, Butts Hill Fort and Turkey Hill and others, and some of which were part of the tour the day before, right? So Mark ran a tour starting at Butts Hill Fort and then moving, I think, to Turkey Hill. And, you know, basically, you know, we had historians there that were restoring Butts Hill and a lot of cool stuff, but Mark took the map and laid it out, right? And
yeah.
and you could talk about it and see it. And the other cool thing that was interesting to me, and I'll get around to a question in a minute, but I guess at the time, the area was clear cut, right? There were no trees of substance, so you know it was, you could see everything better. But it was also cool. Mark would say, "Hey, come over here, Harold," and I would walk over there, and he would show me an angle where I could see the bay, and it really helped me pull it all together. Probably, you know, maybe as much as Gettysburg, right? Walking around Gettysburg and knowing the history there, you know the places, but he was able to pull that together for me. I thought that was very cool. The tour that he took us on, though, was built from a staff ride that you all did, that you worked with at the War College. Is that where that came from?
Yeah, I'm sure Mark could have done the tour just fine without me providing any of that. He knows so much about all the battles. But yeah, I think early on I had sent out to you guys about, yeah, the staff ride that we did. So one of the things that we at the museum did for the college was to design this staff ride to take the students of the college to some of the sites around the Battle of Rhode Island. You know, the whole idea of staff rides is something that usually people in the Army do much more, going to like Civil War battlefields. With the Navy, you know, you can't really do staff rides to naval battles, obviously, unless you just charter a yacht and go out in the middle of the ocean. And then, but so what? You just look at all the water around you. It's like, right. Not much value in that. So, the doing a staff ride to a local land battle, which we happen to have in our backyards, Newport, is still of value to the Naval War College, because I mean there are students from all the branches there anyway, and at their level they're not really studying exclusively naval affairs anyway. It's all very much a joint environment at their level when they're getting up to high staff level positions, so it's still of value to them to study, you know, battles on land, just to look at, you know, study it in terms of the decision-making that happened in the battle, just study the actions of historical commanders, try to understand what they were thinking and the information they had and what they did with it, all of that is still, you know, relevant to students today. So yeah, we as the museum, you know, we've kind of embraced the idea that, as a lot of museums are doing nowadays, that exhibits, physical exhibits, are certainly an important part of what we do, but it's not the only part of what we do. We can serve as educational institutions in other ways than just having a physical exhibit. So a lot of times that may mean doing things online, but it's also about running other educational programs, you know, having speakers and lectures, or doing things like a staff ride. So yeah, I spent a little while putting together, taking a template from an Army staff ride I found from the Army War College and kind of tweaking that a little bit and trying to come up with an option to do like a day-long staff ride around the sites for both the historical events of the Battle of Rhode Island, the siege and the later retreat, and then have some avenues in there where you could talk both about some of the what-ifs of the battle. The Battle of Rhode Island is a very useful tool to use for something like a staff ride because of what could have happened versus what actually did happen, because it was potentially the first battle that would have been a joint operation with the American and the French versus the British, and it didn't end up happening, but it came close to happening. And if it did, that just opens up a whole other series of questions of strategy at the time and decision-making. So doing a staff ride about it makes a lot of sense for that. But yeah, because all the sites are basically within about 20 minutes of the college, it was it seemed like a good thing to do to design that staff ride and have that as an option. So yeah, that was kind of the reason for inventing it and for us just to be more, even more of a resource and a tool for the college to use, to use examples of history to educate today's officers.
I wanted to close with asking you to tell a little story. And I know that you're writing a piece for our Conflicts of Interest online about this. But and by the way, we have Mark wrote a nice summary of the entire event, including the tours and the con itself, which is also on Conflicts of Interest online. So I'll plug that. But you were talking about the inability to go on a staff ride to a naval conflict site for so many reasons. But one of the interesting things I found at the museum that is an American Revolution are the two propellers from a German submarine. And it really, you know, this in a, it just gives me pause to think about how much history there really has been in and around Rhode Island and the Bay itself. But can you briefly tell the story of the propellers and where they came from and the story behind that submarine?
Yeah, those two propellers are from a German U-boat, U-853. That was a U-boat that was sunk at the very end of World War II in 1945. One of the last U-boats to come over to North America in May of 1945. The U-boat showed up right outside, very close to the entrance to Narragansett Bay. It was close to Block Island off of in Rhode Island. The captain, this was the day before VE Day was declared, and the German high command had already sent out messages to all the U-boat captains telling them to come back to Germany, saying we're going to surrender tomorrow and the war is over. So, you know, don't kill yourself. Come on back home. For reasons that we do not know and will never know, the captain of U-853 was very young. He was only 24 years old, so a pretty young U-boat officer. We don't know if he was just a Nazi diehard who said, nope, I'm going to fight to the very end for the Führer, or if he didn't get the message, which is more likely, that they just were, you know, under the surface, or the message didn't come through and they didn't receive it. But for whatever reason, they didn't get the order, didn't follow it, and kept looking for ships to torpedo, which they did. Torpedoed a merchant ship called the Black Point. And once that ship sank, the U.S. Navy ships that were in the area obviously then knew that there was a U-boat nearby. They sent some destroyers out to locate U-853D, which they did, and sank it. The wreck is there. It's a very popular dive location now. There are still people who go diving on it all the time, sometimes bring up things they shouldn't, which since it's a warship wreck site, you're not supposed to take any artifacts from that. But occasionally we get people in the museum who say they have something that they, you know, brought up from a dive back in the 70s or 80s or something. But we have those two propellers who are were given to the museum about 15, 20 years ago. I think it was before I was at the museum, but they used to be over at one of the yacht clubs in Newport, and then the yacht club turned it over to the Navy. When they did turn it over to the Navy, they actually invited representatives of the German Navy to come and be part of that ceremony, which they did. And it was kind of a cool thing to have U.S. and German naval officers together to dedicate that memorial that's there. But over the years, some of the remains of the German sailors who were on that U-boat have been found and brought, and they're actually buried in the in Island Cemetery, the local cemetery that's in Newport. So their graves are still there. But it's a sad story, as most wartime stories are, of a lot of needless deaths that didn't have to happen. Is, you know, nothing that they were going to do at that point had any effect on the war's outcome anyway. It was well past that point, and they certainly didn't. If only they had gotten the message or followed the message or the order or whatever it was, you know, maybe they could have made it home. But unfortunately, that's not how it turned out. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's an interesting story to end on. I would encourage anybody that's in the Newport, Rhode Island area to make an appointment well in advance, because you have to go through security, or at least most of us do, to get onto the base, but to stop by and see the museum at the U.S. Naval War College. A lot of interesting stuff in and around, and certainly seek out Rob to talk to you about it and about war games while you're there. Sorry to volunteer your time, Rob, but I know you'd be happy to see war gamers come through.
If I have to talk to somebody about war games and play a game as part of my official duties, I mean, it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. Yeah.
do what you have to do. Well,
that's right.
Thanks again to you and the crew at the U.S. Naval War College Museum. It was a fantastic, fantastic event. And we're working with you closely on what's next. So thanks, Rob, and appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Yeah, no, it was great to work with you and everyone with SDSCon too. It was a good partnership, I thought. I think we divided the workload really well and made it happen. So happy to have done it and looking forward to the next one.
One of the nation's best known resorts is Newport, famed for its elaborate summer homes. In the old sections of Newport, history comes alive along the narrow streets. During the British occupation of Newport during the Revolution, the tyrannical General Richard Prescott had his headquarters in this house.
Next, we talk to designer Mark Miklos. The father of GMT games, Battles of the American Revolution, and more specifically in this case, the Battle of Rhode Island.
The most interesting historical marker in Newport, to many, is this mysterious tower, known as the Old Stone Mill. The worn inscription on its rocks never has been fully deciphered, but it is believed that the mill may have been built by roving Vikings centuries before Columbus discovered America.
I don't know that I've ever been to a convention that had such incredible, clear linkage to what happened historically at that physical location and a game that we spent several days and playing and enjoying at the con.
You know, more than one, you're right. And more than one person said that, you know, first there was the opportunity to hear about the story, you know, through me sharing some of the history and the local experts sharing some of their on-site expertise as well. And then the chance to literally walk that ground and over to Turkey Hill as well. You didn't get to go on that second, right. second bit. But by then the weather had cleared. It was sunny. It was gorgeous. There was a breeze. We had nice views from there. There was a interpretive plaque that we kind of huddled around and we could point to things. So we heard the story. We walked the ground. We played the game. And that's a trifecta, but wait, there's more, because when you lift your head up from the game board, what are you looking at? You're looking at artifacts, right? So the tangible physical evidence is all around you to complement the narrative that you're creating at the game table, which is informed by the tour you took on the ground and the story you heard. And I just can't ever, like you say, I can't remember a time when that many threads pulled together. And Harold, I got to tell you, probably as I think through all of that and what might I have enjoyed the most, it was the joy that was being experienced by all those players. I mean, you came and joined us for the second heat, and the second heat corresponded to the only one of the teach and plays that didn't make. So there were no other people other than just maybe a casual pair of guys who were doing something on their own. But that teach and play, the first one, 12 to 14 people that corresponded to heat one. The energy in that room and the narrative that was emerging at the different tables as these players, you know, experienced the game and even the extra little dynamic of having the Hessians, and the British being played by separate players. Even that, you know, created a vector for even more entertainment, you know, and I floated from table to table, and frankly, less than half the time I had to answer rules questions or interpretations of things. Most of the time it was just, you know, grooving on their experience, the vibe, the joy, the narrative, you know, the energy. Oh, it was just terrific. I don't think I'll ever forget it.
Yeah.
Then over here on the other side of the room, you had the tournament players, and they're a little more serious. There's a great picture that was taken, I think, of might have been Bruno Passacantando and Larry Berman, maybe it was them. But each of them were, you know, head on the hand like this, staring deep in concentration, you know, like the next move's going to make or break the game, you know. And so they were doing their thing in deep concentration, competing, loving it. And then on the other side of the room, all those people just having a heyday with the teach and play. I didn't think, to be brutally honest with you, I didn't know what to expect with teach and play. I didn't have a baseline to go by, but I don't think I expected it to be as successful as it was.
Yeah.
So that was big.
Yeah. For me. Yeah. I think, I expected it, but then, as you said, you know, I walked into that room. So the majority of the people at the convention came to your tour. You know, the tours of the day were the Battleship Massachusetts and then your tour starting at 1 o'clock. And the majority of people at the convention, I think, came to both, but came to your presentation on the Battle of Rhode Island. And so from that, I said, wow, we're going to have a big turnout at the teach and play. And then I walked into the room at the teach and play, and there's just people stacked, just having a blast. And that was, you know, very clear at that point that it had exceeded my expectations of what connecting the history to a convention could actually be.
if we hearken back to 6 or 8 months ago, whenever you and I had that other opportunity to do a podcast, and you broached this idea, this original idea, and we talked about it, and we talked about the element of the 250th anniversary as well coming up, and you talked about, you know, maybe treating this as a beta test to just discover whether there was any purchase in the idea of going to a location that has historical context in order to take advantage of either a tour, a lecture, a historical site of some sort, and then also play some games that might be thematically connected. You know, I think we proved that that's very doable, that that has real has a real element of success to it.
Yeah, I think so too. And it makes sense, right? I mean, we're all interested in the history, and we all, not all of us, but many of us love to walk the battlefields and just, you know, cover the same ground. So it wasn't a terrible surprise, but I just never expected that, you know, across the board enthusiasm for the group. And the, you know, the museum, it was in no small part a component of that as well.
And as I wrote in that little summary that you graciously offered to Crosspost, thank you for doing that. I related in that little summary how when we were setting up the big board for the final on Sunday morning, folks in the teach and play also had said, "Oh, I used to live in this hex right here," you know, that sort of thing. But on the big board, it's so visual, right? And passersby who were arriving for the day, going to the different parts of the museum to play their games, almost had to pass by us because of where the Revoir room was located. They had to come by the big board. And so, of course, it's so visual, people would pause and look. And we got so many more of those comments, which were great. "Oh, I buy my beer here." You know, I mean, how cool is that? and Volko was very gracious to make comments that morning too, so that Sunday morning, about, you know, how often will we have an experience like this where we are on the ground and then play the game and then we're in the museum looking at the artifacts. I mean, so even though he wasn't on the tour, he had stayed on the battleship, as I understand it. He still, nevertheless, was right in the swing of understanding how this dynamic, you know, works that we're describing.
Although less than half of Rhode Island is devoted to farming, highly scientific methods of agriculture have developed a high yield per acre. The State College at Kingston specializes in research and instruction in the raising of small farm produce. And they do pretty well, too, by the looks of this fine crop of Irish cobbler potatoes.
Next, we talk to Volko Runka about his experience at the convention.
Have resulted in improving plants such as this high-growing, heavy-bearing blueberry bush. Now just bring on that flaky pie crust.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you that one aspect, this may be a bit odd because it's not at the museum, that I'll never forget is the Battleship Cove visit. And I, you know, for the Battleship Massachusetts, I got there a little bit late, or I somehow got separated away from the main group. You know, I know you guys were assembling on the fantail for photos, and I somehow managed to miss all of that. I don't know why. So I did listen to a little bit of the docent there, which was interesting. But most of the time, it was me and a couple other guys from the con walking that battleship, and it was like I was like a 10-year-old boy in a toy store or something, you know. It was that kind of just fun. And I think I mentioned we saw from one of the guys who I was with there was Mark Greenwald. He, afterwards, we got off and he looked at his Fitbit and we had walked 3 miles on that ship that day. And I know I ended up then missing the afternoon battlefield tour because we were hanging out on the ship. And the thing that was cool about it, because I've toured battleships and other, you know, naval museums like that. But in addition to just being generally in a naval mood because of the theme of the con, and I just happen right now to be, as from time to time, I get intensely interested in the Pacific War, World War II Pacific, which I am now. In addition to that, it was like, which was the right time for me to do something like that. Just being with those guys, Jerry White, my friend Roberto Settala, and we, you know, a guy, they're like me, that they're, you know, they don't know all that stuff, right? They haven't necessarily been inside a 16-inch gun mount turret to see how the ammunition is loaded, whatever. And we're just kind of wanting, like, trying to figure out, well, why is this, you know, why is this divot here and why does that thing stick out there? And of course, we're amateurs, we don't know what we're doing, but we all enjoyed the puzzle together. And then we'd bump into guys, other guys, I think from the con, or maybe they're just guys on the ship, I don't know, they weren't guys I knew, who were clearly really deep into it and it could explain a lot of stuff. And so it's just that particular company, you know, in that particular museum, the battleship itself at that particular time for me was just magical. So, you know, I love the games and I love everybody else who was there and met, and the you know, the museum on the War College, the original War College building, the setting, the weather when we were there on Saturday and Sunday, everything was glorious. But I just am never going to forget crawling around that battleship with those guys.
It was good. You, Roberto and I drove there together, and you know, we signed in and then again, like, as you said, you just kind of, you wandered off, and I did notice until I had to get back to head to the Battle of Rhode Island tour. And I called you and you said, you know, I'm going to get another ride. And I was telling the story the other day, and maybe I embellished it, but I don't think I saw you again until Saturday morning.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's right. So, so it was, I had met Jerry White before. And of course, Roberto and I had traveled up there together. He's local to me, so I see him a lot. And I had, palled around with Mark Greenwald, who's doing professional wargaming out at, Fort Leavenworth now, but I know him via Levian Campaign. He's a Levian Campaign designer, has two games going for that series. So, you know, so I knew all of them, but it was really good, great chance to hang out. And so after we got off the battleship, finally, we went for a local late lunch and then puzzled out where and how to recharge Jerry's electric rental car, which we figured out. And we ended up going back to the hotel and playing Pacific Fury, which was a game that, it's a little game about the Solomon's campaign. So it's quite fitting and thematic. You know, it was like, you know, on trajectory for the con in that regard, although we failed to report either for the battleship tour or anything at the museum that evening. And I walked from the hotel, walked down into town, got a couple of six packs, and just in the hotel lounge area, the four of us played and critiqued, you know, Pacific Fury, which was great fun. And throughout all of that day and evening, it was a more chance than I had ever had to, because I know the other two guys well, more chance than I ever had to get to know Jerry, Jerry White, and pick his brain about game design. And in particular, like, you know, bounce a couple of problems I was working on a design I'm working right now. And very thought provoking. And, you know, talking to him is kind of like playing Atlantic Chase. It's sort of, you're not really sure exactly what's going on and why, but damn, it's fascinating. And you kind of keep probing. that's the feeling I had getting to know him better. Really beneficial for me.
Yeah. He's great. He's a very kind, very sweet guy, but a big brain and as you mentioned, nonlinear, right?
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it was great fun to have him there. He's on my list of people to speak to as well. If I can get it all in.
Well, you must.
Yes. Yes. The venue, once you got to the War College and the museum, it was a pretty unique place to play World War II games as well, right? And there was, I think, in one room in particular where you and Mark Herman and Jerry, I think, ended yep. up, and you were,
that's right.
you were on either side of you were, I don't know if they were functional, but torpedoes.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing to be in a building like that, a museum, and have one of the other designers with you not only be physically there, but also be in a display case across the way, which is Mark Herman, who has a one of his games with John Butterfield, a professional game, is in the display case there. I think you've got a picture of Mark standing next to, you know, and I'm like, Mark, you're like a museum relic, but here you are actually still walking around. This is awesome. that was quite moving. Yeah, the only thing that I had that's similar to that is Sebastian Bay has run some of his like final exam game sessions where he brings in people like me, like, you know, graveyards or whatever, to play the students' games and try them out. And I think then they get graded. And he does that sometimes in the museum at Annapolis at the Naval Academy. And it's very similar with, you know, ship models everywhere and diagrams of campaigns and so forth. And so I was playing, I did, I think, 4 demos of Hunt for Blackbeard in that museum space at the con. And downstairs, among all the ship models there, the one that really caught my eye was a privateer sloop, beautiful model of a privateer sloop. Now, it was from, I think, 1780, you know, it's American Revolutionary War privateer. But to me, it looked the same as the Bermuda sloops of 1718, which are both the Hunters, the Royal Navy sloops hunting Blackbeard and Blackbeard's own sloop adventure that are depicted in the game. And so that was pretty cool. So yeah, so the idea of, I mean, all that around you and you know where you are, the history of the place, and then, you know, then engaging in games that are, you know, part of that same realm historically. Yeah, that's I found that very potent.
Right. And the models were, you know, this wasn't the old Revell model of our youth, right? These models are huge and they're incredibly detailed. That are in the display case.
And I have to presume very accurate. And, you know, just kind of, again, an echo, more toys for me to look at. The Massachusetts, I guess, has been a museum for a long time. That was not that long after World War II that they took that ship out of service and put it there in Battleship Cove. So it is accumulated. I mean, the inside of the ship is a big museum of other stuff, you know, displays on PT boats and, right, you know, all sorts of things, and all chock full of models as well. So I had that on Friday, and then all that cool stuff around for me Saturday, Sunday at the con.
Right. Yeah, I think it was you know, as an experiment, right, to try to link a historical location with a convention. It certainly, and maybe we pre-selected, right? Maybe only the people came that would be interested in walking the history as well as playing the games. But you know, this idea that you know, a game convention doesn't have to be in a antiseptic location; it should be somewhere. Or it can be, and it would be beneficial for it to be close to something, right, that inspires us to play games and to visualize and to think about.
Yeah. Now, I mean, do you do this at home? Because if I play a game, like right now, it's, you know, the Japanese and the Allies in the Pacific, and I play, you know, in the 1940s, right? So I play Koto music and I play big band music, you know, Benny Goodman, stuff like that. And then, or, you know, US Navy martial music, like that sort of thing, Victory at Sea. And I might drink sake while I'm playing. I mean, do you do that? Do you like this other atmospheric things, maybe even burn Japanese incense, you know, anything like that? Mm-hmm. I find, you know, it's really what I'm after anyway, is immersion and time travel. And so all of that, I think it's like art in a game. You don't really need great art to have a war game that works really well and has interesting decisions and strategy and is realistic and all that kind of stuff, right? But boy, it sure takes you somewhere, the art, right?
Right, right.
And so it would make sense that the surroundings matter too.
It's funny. So I've had the good luck of gaming with you in your home, and also with Mark Herman. And the one thing I take away from gaming with both of you guys, you know, with these incredible design resumes and capabilities, is that you are both heavily immersed. You're not trying to figure. It's not a puzzle experience. You both are transported, right? I mean, you know, Mark. The experience with Mark is much the same. Not necessarily that he's eating. You know, he's playing Nevsky and eating turkey legs from the Ren Fair, but. But again, you know, when he looks at a map, he doesn't look at hexes and square pieces of cardboard. He talks about the people. And,
yeah.
Right. And it's a transport that really is a gift and part of the passion that you both share.
Well, I'm very happy to be in that company, but that's absolutely how I feel about it. We're getting together, all you and I and others who go to places like SD HistCon East. You know, I mean, Mark Herman loves chess, right? And he spends time on that as well, of course. So it's not that he's not into strategy and puzzles, maybe. But it's not the agenda when we gather for something like SD HistCon. We're not there to play puzzles because we'd just be playing abstract games. We're there for the hist, I think.
Yeah.
First.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's reflected in, I think it's sometimes reflected in our strategies, right? I mean, how many times have you played a game and thought, well, this is what they did, right? I know enough about the situation. Yeah. You know, maybe it's a battle and I know enough about the situation to know this is how they played it and I'm going to.
Yeah.
Try something similar, right?
That is what I tell myself frequently to explain why I'm losing. is that you know, I want to reproduce the history, you know, and
right.
So I want to see. It's very often when I have a new game too. Like my main question about it is, can this reproduce historical outcomes, historical? Not that I want it to be on rails and only, obviously I want there to be agency and the opportunity for things to happen that might have happened but didn't. Of course, that's why we should play games and not just read books. But I find myself, you know, I know the model can do all kinds of things, you know, and I know that I can try all kinds of imaginative things, but can the model also, with, you know, relatively reasonable player decisions, could it reproduce the historical outcomes? That's always a big question for me about my own games as I'm designing them and tweaking them and testing them and all. But it's also with others. And so I tend to, therefore, to run that experiment, do what you said, which is I kind of say, well, I'm going to do what I think they did historically, more or less, and see how that plays out. Does it work? You know, to me, that's a part of buying the model, which is, again, if I don't buy the model, it's hard to get transported. So I'm not a particularly effective, I think, player, because of course I'm just predictable and following suboptimal strategies.
As long as you know the history, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, maybe I'm not reproducing it precisely. But so when we played, I mentioned Pacific Fury, which is a brilliant little design, Japanese design. And we have, you know, three of us are game designers, and the fourth one, Roberto, is a fairly intense game war gamer. And a lot of the discussion is of, you know, is that really, could the Turkey Express really do that? You know, and how come we have such high losses here? And why couldn't I fly my, you know, why couldn't my aircraft carrier sail over here? You know, it's all that kind of, and you, I think if you listen to us, we were even commenting on ourselves, by the end of the session, you'd think we hated this game because we just tried to trash it, but it's just kind of a part of the fun of it for me. And I think these guys were similar, is comparing that model to history and the possibilities of history. And there's no knowing for sure, because history went the way it did. You know, they didn't decide to sail their aircraft carriers here. Would they have ever? Could they have? Did they ever consider it? You know, who knows, right? In many cases. But we just, it's just a part of the fun and the sharing is, you know, pushing the model around in that way and critiquing it in that way against history.
Yeah. You know, I always, as soon as we have these conversations, I just start wondering what is the population of, you know, of people that play these games? We know so little about this group of people we call war gamers, historical gamers, right? I mean, we impose our own models of who we are on them.
Yeah.
Assume that's who they are, but I think we're wrong. And well, we know we're wrong, right? So
yeah.
I'm curious as to how many of them. I mean, you know, maybe that's the definition of a war gamer, right? Maybe it's not the definition isn't, or historical gamer, but the definition isn't the games we play, but it's how we play them and what we think about when we play them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a, you know, there's a wide variety of approaches. You know, we know that there's a group of people coming into the hobby that may not care as much about history as you and I do.
Yeah.
And again, completely fine, right? I mean, we could be criticized for being obsessive about it, or at least I could. I would never criticize you, Volko, but but you know, there are people that come into it that really don't know what happened, right? Or don't think about it. And maybe they're informed by it, but
In my sense of it is, first of all, I think you're right. I don't think we know what the distributions are in the population of players. And my sense of it is individuals play games. I mean, just like, why are you playing this game, right? Individuals play games, play board games, play war games for a variety of different reasons, a wide range of reasons, but there are tendencies. And the tendencies of the priorities of those reasons might define groups, tribes usefully within the larger population. And I'm very interested in that about people going, as I always do, going back to the concept of models and that these games are models. And if we define a model as purposeful simplification, and therefore we accept simplifications, abstractions, errors to purpose, we accept them if they're purposeful, then what is the purpose of this model? What is the purpose of this game? What design are you trying to do with this game that isn't already out there on the market? Is a critical question as you think about the experience. And it's a very tightly related question to why does an individual player play this game? What is, I don't know that there's a value to that, you know, to say that one purpose in playing a game is loftier than another. I doubt it. Maybe I could be convinced of that, but I doubt it. I think it's a matter of personal taste, preference, interest, whatever. And there's a lot of overlap. And I do think, as you point out, a tendency among those of us who call ourselves war gamers is leading with the interest in history. It's not the only reason we play, and it may not be the main reason we play. It's almost certainly in the mix for all board war gamers. but it's a distinguishing tendency, I would say, is first I want to get into this history. Maybe it's because I don't know anything about it and I want to learn. Maybe I know a lot about it, but I want to see what this particular designer thinks the dynamics were, or I want to experiment, you know, in a way that I can't do by reading a book, whatever. You know, that then history is a part of the reason I'm there at the table. And that's a way then to also examine how well does this game suit me? You know, you and I might love and hate respectively the same game. And it might have to do with, well, what, when we sit down at the what are we looking for to get out of that game? And it may be that it really matches what the designer was trying to give us, did so skillfully, is matches very well what I'm after and not so well what you're after. And again, that just tells you, I guess that's a fancy way of saying taste is a big determiner of, you know, what we do and how we evaluate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the jury matters so much too in determining whether it's a lofty, or whether you've accomplished a lofty goal or not. Right. But the other thing that's interesting is, as we think through this, is that what you may intend when you make your game, or not intend, but expect people will get from your game, can often be different.
Very different.
The experience that they have.
Yeah. Which I find very exciting.
Yeah.
That player reaction, in-game innovation, learning possibly, critique. It's like the exceptional case where I get some of that kind of feedback on a published design, and I'm like, yeah, that's what I was expecting. You know, good or bad, I was expecting this would be a problem, or I was expecting this would be a kudos or whatever. That's the atypical case. Usually it's a criticism or an appreciation that is new to me as the designer. Mm-hmm. And so right there, isn't that, that's evidence of how much the player individually matters to the experience, mm-hmm. right? This is not a passive, this is like a two-way communication, right? We're sharing in both directions with creation happening on both sides, the delivery of the game and the operation of it by the player.
Next, we talk to Mike Smart, also known as Zilla Blitz. Mike will talk about his experience at the SDHISCon at the U.S. Navy War College Museum. And he'll also talk, as one of the newest members of the SDHISCon crew, about his experience with SDHISCon and what it meant for him in his re-entry into wargaming.
It was the first wargaming conference I've ever been to. And I'm not sure if you, I think I might have mentioned that before,
yes,
but
yes.
Cause I had a 25 year gap between my wargaming experience. And then when I came back, it was the middle of the pandemic. And so I went to the online conference that you had run. There was like two or three of them. And I just found that so welcoming and so positive and such a fresh look on kind of the wargaming world, that finally I said, okay, no, I really have to try to get to a wargaming conference. And then I'm originally from Massachusetts and the flights were cheap and everything looked really good. So I'm like, oh, this is the perfect opportunity. I can see some friends when I'm out there too. And so it was the first time for me to go. So, I mean, I'm not a shy person, but I was kind of nervous. You know, you're stepping into a conference like that where you don't really know people and stuff like that. But I think that was, you know, I'm going to the one in November now in San Diego because I had such a good time at the one in Newport. I mean, people are so engaging, and a lot of people, you know, you interact with people online, interact with some of the people on the online conferences, you know, social media and stuff like that. So you're not walking into a room full of strangers. There's going to be people, you know, people you've connected with in a lot of different ways. So in many ways, it's kind of like seeing friends for the first time, which is an odd kind of, you know, like juxtaposition, but that's just the way it is. You feel like you know people. You're picking up conversations almost in the middle of a conversation that you've had someplace else, you know?
Yeah, with social media, it pulls us together, but then, you know, you provide content, right? You review games and talk about games, and people are excited about what you do. So you have tons of friends that you don't know, right?
Well, that's kind of it is the funny thing, because there's a lot of people that know me because they've seen me on a video, but I don't know their face. So it's kind of a one-way street until we figure out, oh, wait a second. No, I get who you were. Okay. Got it that way too. So yeah, that's funny. Yeah. But it's such a good group of people, you know, and I think if there are people out there that are thinking a little nervous about going or something like that, for someone like me, had never been to a conference, first time going, everybody there was the first time for me to meet them in person. There's not a single person there I had met in real life before that. And I went by myself and it was great. It was so welcoming and so open and just so much fun. And, you know, people would just sit down, play a game, asking you to play games, just play games the whole weekend. We had the tour of the college. I mean, the facility was great. The food, all the work that you guys did behind the scenes was so much fun. And so I was just glowing when I left. You know, it was just, right. It was really, really fun. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool. And, you know, as conventions go, it was kind of special given the setting. Most of the events aren't in settings like that. So that was, it's kind of funny yes. to talk about that when I'm just thinking, yeah, well, you know, that was a rare.
You know, what I realized after we left is, that's the Newport, Rhode Island that caused all the issues with the torpedoes for U.S. submarines in World War II, right?
Yes.
So we missed like a golden opportunity. I feel like there was something to leverage there that we should have played a game like, you know, like Silent Victory or something like that.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Just
but there was a lot of World War II stuff going on, right? I mean, there was a ton
of Pacific War. For sure. Yeah. On. Empire of the and Sun then, would have been.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yep.
Pacific Chase, the prototype was there too. A ton of people playing that.
Yeah.
So that was really fun to see. And they didn't sure the torpedoes are factored to a certain degree into those games in some
right.
way. Minute.
Yeah. I hope so, right?
But I didn't realize it until after I left. And I think there is, you know, there's torpedoes in the museum and there's the big, I think it's one of the torpedoes outside or something like that.
Yes.
You're taking credit for this, but there's a bit of history here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the test facility was outside. And There's a famous picture of, if you go through some of the vintage Newport pictures, there's a great picture of a beach, right? So
yes,
a public beach and a torpedo. And
there's a woman standing right beside the torpedo on the beach. Yeah, there was a conversation on social media about that where someone's asked, is this a real picture? And I think someone chimed in and said, yeah, no, this actually was a real picture. Yeah, torpedoes functioning as expected.
Right, right. And there's another cool, you know, the other cool thing, I don't know if you noticed, but right outside, of course, there's this giant anchor, right, from the USS yes. Constellation, but there's also two propellers, giant propellers, and they're propellers from a submarine that was sunk just offshore, like spitting distance from where we were.
Okay.
That was sunk with just a few days left in World War II. A German submarine right there, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah, so much good stuff. What did you play then?
So I played your game, Flashpoint South China Sea. That was the first time for me to be able to play that against a human being. That was really fun. Yeah. I think one of my, you know, ironically, doesn't have anything to do with the ocean or with the Navy, because there was definitely a naval theme to it. Mm-hmm. But I played Distant Plane, which was the first time to play that game. We had a group of four people. That was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I really liked playing Rhode Island, the first game, that Teach and Play on Friday night that Mark Miklos ran and organized and things like that. Right. And that was the first time to play one of those games in his series. And we had just such a wild game. It was, you know, one of those games where everything's twisting back and forth. It comes down. And then we had two roles that went from disaster to victory right at the end. And it was just everybody's yelling. It was like, oh, this is so much fun. There's people standing there watching and stuff like that. But yeah, that was really fun too. And then the Hunt for Blackbeard Vocals prototype, we played that. I brought a prototype of The Hunt and we played that one too. And then there's probably three or four other games in there that I'm forgetting too. But yeah,
good.
A lot of fun games. So.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. The designer of The Hunt, Matthias Kramer, is coming to the NovemberCon.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, man, I couldn't be more excited. So that and Watergate, he has some very cool ideas.
I've heard his games described as the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Fair.
And that's the way I feel about The Hunt. You look at The Hunt and you say, okay, that's kind of cool. That's kind of, and then you play it. It just comes together in this magical way. That's like, oh yeah, this is, this is really sharp.
Yeah,
so that's great that he's coming in November. I didn't realize that. So
yeah,
I've not played Watergate yet. So again, I've got this 25-year gap of stuff. I've like, oh, I gotta
catch up.
Yeah, my shelf of opportunity is massive.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I had the same, right? 25 years between when I started school, college,
right.
And just got real serious about stuff going on then, and then kids, and then, you know, when my kids started to move out was kind of when I sought it out again.
That's exactly. The pandemic came, which was when I was sitting in front of screens all the time. And I like gaming in almost any form, any type of game and things like that, especially strategy games and thinking and stuff like that.
Right.
But it was just too much screens.
Yeah.
So even for me, it's like, I wonder if people even make war games anymore. When I looked online and I pulled out an old Pacific War Quad Island game that I had. I'm not sure if you remember those from SBI.
Yes.
They came in
yes.
a bag in the four there. And I pulled it and I played Saipan. It's like, this is actually pretty fun. And so then I bought, I think, Sherman Leader. And now it's like my shelf is full and it's 2.5 years later. And my wife is like, what are you doing? Like, I don't know. It's, I'm having a good time. Leave me alone.
My poor wife, I'll come home with a bunch of games that I buy from something, right? And she'll say,
right.
I thought you already had a bunch of games. Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
yes,
I don't get that. My wife is actually fantastic. She's just so understanding with stuff. And she just, I mean, she shakes her head and stuff like that. But, you know, I think she has more Lululemon bags coming into the house than I do boxes full of
so
games.
So she can't,
you know,
start the process of asking any questions.
Yeah, I've got some ammo that I can toss back at her here.
That's pretty good.
I know, even just yesterday, there was two Lululemon bags that came, and I had one, the final version of The Hunt came. You know, I had the prototype version earlier, and the final version came in. And so that one came in, I opened up, and she's looking at me, and I'm pointing at her two Lululemon bags, and we just reached a stalemate right there. It's like, this is
great.
Well,
the good news is she's being super thrifty with Lululemon, right? Yeah.
I think one of those bags is probably, you could probably get three games with some of the stuff that's in one of those bags. That stuff's not cheap, I don't think.
No doubt.
So, and just talking about kind of the mission of SD HistCon and kind of your look and your take on wargaming and making it inclusive and making it something for everybody. You know, and I think there's for me, that's the message that really resonated with me. And I shared it with you before where, and I'd been out of wargaming before, and there's every hobby has a lot of different people involved, right? But one of my thoughts was, is this a hobby for me? You know, is the people that do this? And when I came to that on the online conference, I said, this is so welcoming, so kind of progressively looking to open up the hobby to share this joyous stuff that we can do with a lot of people, that at some point I think it might be good to talk about that, because I feel like that's an important, I feel like it's an important message for people to hear. And as no matter how many times we say it, I feel like we keep needing to say it more and more, because I think it's easy for people to draw the wrong conclusions or go back to kind of stereotypical messages or old messages or outdated messages. And, you know, I've mentioned your organization and what you're doing to a number of people who have been hesitant about getting back into the hobby or getting into the hobby. And they've all taken it. It's like, oh, I needed to hear that. You know, and that I think it's important that we broaden it out and we kind of include more people and make it something for everybody that wants to be part of it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's not, our approach isn't for everybody, and that's okay, right? It doesn't have to. I'm not trying to convince everybody, and I'm not
trying to win.
You know, we're not trying to move anybody's cheese either, right? You don't have to adapt or die. But we have a view and we're building an organization around it, and we have a bunch of people that have common interests in growing the hobby and being inclusive and seeing more diversity than exists amongst, you know, what now is a hobby dominated by a bunch of old white guys. And again, I love old white guys, right? I'm an old white guy. I have no problems with old white guys or the people that are in the hobby, and I don't want to screw with anybody, but I think that it's important. Those of us that want to grow the hobby and want to make sure that it's well represented, or it represents the real broader community, right? Then it's important for us to make sure that there's a place for people that want that stuff to go.
Yeah,
and totally. If you don't want it, then you know you don't have to be involved. in what we do, right?
Yeah.
And if you have a different preference, that's cool too. And we're not trying to change people. We're just trying to give a nice big broad landing place. And it seems to be, the message seems to be resonating with people. Mm. It was great hearing your story and the fact that at the online convention, and we draw a couple hundred people to an online convention, and that from that you got a very positive message about growth and inclusivity and kindness and all of those other things. So it's great to hear you say that.
Yeah. And I wonder what would have happened had I not had that experience, because it was also that same first one where Stuka Joe, I think he gave a presentation on how to make videos.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there was the conference experience and then him saying, I had done a little bit of video work before. And I'm like, that looks kind of fun. They tossed up a video about Africa Corps and all of a sudden, I didn't think anyone was going to watch it. And like all of a sudden people started watching it and giving probably, it's like, oh, maybe I'll do that again, and started doing more stuff. And so it was just like this perfect confluence of kind of serendipity or coincidence or whatever it was, that this really reinforcing conference connected with an interest in video creation and telling stories through games.
With a guy that does an excellent job at that to give him some ideas, right?
Yes.
Stuka Joe's work's wonderful.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. It was, and he's been so helpful. I connected with him after, and again, kind of that message of inclusivity and willing to help people out. I mean, we connected probably 2 or 3 hours after that, and he just kept offering up his time. So this is what I did. This is what I did. I might do it this way. This is something I might recommend. It was super helpful to get my studio set up and advice on making videos and things like that too. So, again, it was that kind of that combination of those two experiences. And had that not happened, I'm not sure. I might have just wandered into something else. There's tons of hobbies that people can pick from, so
thanks for sharing that, and I'm glad that you're in circulation, right? I'm glad we can see you out at conventions now and love your content, so keep it up.
Thank you very much. It's been, I think the biggest thing for me, and the thing that I mentioned a lot too, has been that sense of community that was something I didn't expect. I did not expect it as I was jumping into the hobby, because I like games, I like narrative. I play solitaire, I play with other people. I just like to play games and things like that. And I like creating videos. I never expected there would be that sense of community or connection that people would be welcoming into the hobby, even kind of connecting with designers and players and kids and parents and stuff like that. And that's what I think has really made it sustaining, if that makes sense,
Right.
So that was something I didn't expect. It's been really fun. But yeah, I think, that inclusivity and the diversity, that might be a separate thing for a separate time. You had mentioned talking about maybe an article or something like that, but I'd be happy to have that conversation at some point, because I feel like it's an important message that can change the way people react to our hobby,
right. So. And some people know, right? That's not what they're looking for. That's not what they want. And
but I think you worded it right. It's not a fight. It's just this is what we want to do.
Right. No, disagreement by its nature doesn't mean that we need to hate each other, right?
Exactly. It's like you could do whatever you want to do. That's okay. Yeah. Just all you have to do to be a nice person is nothing. That's it. Just go over there and do what you want to do. That's cool. That's all it takes.
We're cool. That's right. Yeah, plenty of convention space. Yeah. Well, that was excellent. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me tonight.
For sure. The pleasure is all mine. Thanks for reaching out and offering to connect and things like that. It's been a really fun conversation.
Favorite of the cool crowd and the not so cool is the Newport Jazz Festival, highlight of the summer season. Covered avidly by international press representatives, the festival gains new brilliance each year. Top musical performers like Dave Brubeck, Dizzy Gillespie, Frank Sinatra come back yearly to give Rhode Island that special, swinging but sweet touch that caps out its summer madness, that glad madness of Rhode Island on the go.
Well, that's it for the second podcast in this 3-podcast series. Be sure to watch for the 3rd podcast, including conversations with participants in the SD HISCON U.S. Navy War College Museum event from 2023.
Well now, think you've seen something? Not really. This has been just a small taste of Rhode Island on the go. Next summer, why not come where the fun crowd is, to the cool, swinging, pleasure-minded state that's always on the go. Rhode Island.